Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's go back to 2011 with Squidge. Let's look at the World Cup again with Squidge.
Hello, and welcome to the Squidge Rugby World Cup Retrospective Podcast, the rugby podcast.
You just said that correctly in one go.
I know. We also, I want to make it clear that we are the only rugby podcast now.
We are the only one.
And
we're also a film podcast. There are no others. One of them.
They don't. Yeah, there's loads of film podcasts though, but we're the only one that is a rugby podcast as well.
Yeah.
There's loads of other podcasts. There's none about rugby.
Yeah.
So I just want to make that clear right at the beginning. We're the only podcast
about
rugby.
That's why, of course, when you search for this podcast on our podcast or whatever, wherever you find your podcasts, you find it under the rugby category rather than films, because that's really populated.
Yeah.
I know we talk about films, but because we put it under rugby, we're always number one because we're the only one.
So joining me for the One Rugby podcast is, as ever, Will Owen. Hello.
Hello.
And here to talk more about Friends with Benefits, presumably, our resident expert on flags and or stats and Mila Kunis, Sam Lana. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Thank you very much for having me. I was a little bit shocked when you introduced us as a rugby podcast. I couldn't quite see how Friends with Benefits was going to fit into that, but I'm glad you saved it there with my introduction.
So have you, since we last checked in, watched the film Friends with Benefits starring Justin Timberlake and Mila Kunis?
You know, it would be poetically beautiful if I had, but I have not.
Oh, man.
I believe it's gone off Netflix.
Oh, no way. Should we all have like a group watch of it sometime?
I think that would be best.
Yeah.
What's the most boring game in the rest of the 2011, 2015 or 2019 World Cup? Can we just replace that with...
That's a good question. Robbie, any thoughts?
I mean, we already did England-Argentina. You know, we already had you there.
Scotland-Georgia.
Scotland-Georgia has been covered. Cammy was exceptional in... You know, there's no one you'd want more to talk about Scotland being boring than Cammy Black. But yeah, I don't know what... I mean, the next game is South Africa 87, Namibia 0, which isn't much of a contest.
Yeah, that was... Well, that was similar thing in 2019 as well, wasn't it? I think
that was
I remember, what was the one played after the typhoon? Was it Ireland-Russia? I remember that being exceptional.
Ireland-Russia was
No. That was a Ramil Gaissin masterclass. That was incredible.
Oh, God. I haven't talked about the Ramil Gaissin.
We need to catch up, man. Ramil Gaissin, still the best 10 in the world, as far as I'm concerned. Obviously, not a lot of rugby's been played recently, but...
He's been playing every week in the Russian League.
Oh, has he?
Yeah. I watched him play.
Watching that more.
He's still doing his thing. By his thing, I mean cross kicks every single face.
The quarterback of the rugby world. I didn't know he was playing in Russia at the moment. Let's check him out.
I believe he's the third top scorer in the league to date, which is a thing I know off the top. Why do I know that?
I couldn't
tell you what a dog is, but I could tell you who the third top scorer in the Russian league at the minute is.
Slightly offensive comparing the male geising to a dog.
I'm not comparing it to a dog. I'm just saying I don't know what dogs are. I've been wondering for ages. Like, I saw one in a cafe today and I was like, is that a dog or is that a cheese sandwich?
I think if Ramil Gaissin had a dog, I think he would get a lot of exercise from how far Gaissin would be kicking the balls for him to chase.
He'd just be chasing, he'd be chucking tennis balls into really inconvenient places.
Yeah, with his two legs in the air as he boots it away, as he jumps.
He'd be throwing the tennis ball deliberately into trees so his dog could fetch it. His dog can learn practical skills.
He'd do a quadruple pirouette before he throws the frisbee for his dog to chase. It'd be glorious.
During rugby training where your coach would kick the ball, you'd all go and run around it, and whoever was last would pick up the ball and put it back to the coach. And then you'd kick it again, and you'd all run around it, and whoever was last would pick up the ball. And you'd just do that until the coach decided not to.
Coach Gaissin.
Bill Gaissin was your coach.
I bet he invented that drill.
Athletics team do.
It's such a that I don't know where that was going to go. I was just going to link it back to Romeo Gyson because he's a wonderful man. Also, I love the fact that a man with his hairline is playing fly half.
Oh, I know. It's such a hawker's hairline, isn't it?
Yeah. It's that man has no business being, you know, not like under 35 and playing fly half in international rugby.
No. And he looks like he's about 5 pounds away from playing number 8 as well. Mm. Like, he's
portly rather than well built.
Yeah.
Like he's had a few too many Sunday dinners.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a fairly odd looking man. I mean, you know, fair play to him for pulling off. I think he pulls off the look.
Definitely.
At the risk of just derailing this even further, I am going to try and find a... Oh, here he is. Here he is. How do I... I can put this into the Zoom, can I think? I'm sharing, just for everyone at home, I'm sharing... No, I'm not. Okay, I'm sharing. to a Russian cyclist. And I want you to click on that link, and without looking at his age, which is admittedly quite prominent on that page,
it's right there. Yeah,
all that man,
like Jesus it. Christ, that's Alexander Yanushkin.
he looks 38. Would have been my guess had I not known.
I would guess 39.
Yes. So for the purpose of this, he's a guy called Dmitry Strakhov, Strakhov. He is 25. This is something that will not work on a...
No, we'll attach it to like Twitter or something.
He's the same age as me.
Yeah.
So, he's just under a month older than me. Right. Christ. In just under a month, I'm going to look like that.
Well, he looked... If you click on the picture, you can see that what he looked like 3 years ago when he was, by maths, 22... And if anything, he looks older than he looks.
Yeah. Yeah, he's somehow aged back. You know, have you seen any of the What We Do in the Shadows TV series?
A couple of episodes, yeah.
He looks a bit like Colin the Energy Vampire.
See?
He looks like an incredible... No, he looks like a very boring man is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah, he does look like a boring man.
Like, he will talk to you at length about the kind of printer jet you need in the printer, copy of the paper that's needed in the thing. I don't listen, so I don't actually know those details. He probably, his favourite TV show is Golden Balls, and he constantly tells you he thinks it should come back.
Yes. Fair play to him and the Emil Gysing. They're doing what they can with what they've got, but it's unfortunate.
Right, okay. We're going to mention the game now. The match of today's podcast focus is actually a genuinely good game. So if people remember, when Sam was on last, we covered England v Argentina, which is one of the most boring rugby matches of all time. Yeah. So we figured we'll get you a match that is not only far more entertaining as a rugby match, but includes two far more exciting flags. So it's Tonga against Japan.
Yes. Can I briefly... I don't want to. I really don't want to derail this podcast, but can I briefly talk about rugby bit about tactics?
Ooh, please.
I was watching this game, and we spoke a little bit about this before. That I actually can't remember this game from when I was live. But watching this back, you can see the green shoots of Japanese rugby's progression at this point. And I encourage everyone to watch this game because it is a game.
And the full game's on YouTube as well. It's uploaded in two parts. So it's not even like you've got to click through 8 videos in order, you know, that stop and one of them's missing.
With English commentary as well. It's not in Czech this time. So
yes.
Although one try is missing.
Mario
Polo try is missing.
Yeah. But then the full replay shows it from about where the coverage cuts out.
Yeah.
So I don't know what happens there.
Yeah. But Japan basically, the thing that stops them from being what they're like in 2015 and more so in 2019 is their accuracy is really poor.
Yes.
So they try and play out of their own 22 twice that I can remember, and both the first time leads kind of indirectly to a try, and the second time is in the second half where the outside centre, Alisi Tupalaya,
yeah,
he flings a kind of a not particularly good pass at Engo, the winger, and it just gets knocked on. But they're trying to do what they ended up doing in 2015 and 2019, but it's just not working.
Yeah.
But what I thought was really interesting, rather than just the fact that they're more accurate now, is you can see that they're playing like a normal rugby team. Like, they're doing similar stuff to what a normal rugby team would do. So they're going, they're attacking the same direction. They're playing with pod systems. They're playing like, a Teng drift, pop pass back inside, and all these kind of things that we're seeing from teams. And then in 2015, and definitely in 2019, they clearly just go, well, the best we can be is quite a good rugby team doing this. Let's completely trash that and be something completely different and actually see how good we can be.
This is my big pet peeve that I've talked about quite a lot, is teams that appoint, especially Tier 2 nations, they'll often appoint someone on the strength of their CV rather than what they're going to bring to it. Yeah. So the thing that Japan got really right in hiring Eddie Jones and then Jamie Joseph is that they were coaches who built a game plan around the players in front of them. And that's pretty much Eddie Jones' thing. It's like every team he plays with plays incredibly differently, but that's the thing that unites them, is that they all play like you'd expect that nation to. You know, so his Japan team were kind of quick, his Australian team were very sort of well-organised backs, and his England team, obviously largely forward-based, but with this real cohesion throughout the entire side. And it's harsh to say they're forward-based. They were in the first 18 months he was in charge. And then I thought Uruguay got this right in hiring Esteban Meneses, because he very much built it. He went, right, what can I work on? What have I got? I've got a team that works hard. Let's build an entire game plan around that. And those are the teams that work best, and those are the coaches that work best. And it's matching the style of rugby to the players you've got available, because as a Tier 2 country, you don't have the option to try and blood through and bring through different players. You're given a squad of maybe 35 players who are capable of playing at test intensity, if that, and you've got to try and get the most out of them, you know. And that's what Tier 2 coaching is about. It's a very different sport to club coaching and to coaching Tier 1 nations.
Yeah, the principal example of that, not a Tier 2 nation, but is Razzy Erasmus with the Springboks side.
Yes, absolutely.
He's got the best out of like that massive pack he had, and a good ball handling backline who could kick the leather off the ball. It perfectly suited this shithouse Munster coach, you know, who's been milling about for the last couple of years. But to build on Sam's point a minute ago, that I similarly don't remember anything about this game. I'm not entirely sure if I watched it at the time, so I don't remember anything about that. But you're right, that Japanese. There were shades of 2015 and 2019 in there. There was one point in particular when they're playing out the 22 and they had Ryan Nicholas run a hard line off 9 and Shota Horia was the man who called it out the back. And playing that sort of a shape wasn't really a thing in 2011, especially with your hooker as the first receiver. And the one thing with this Japanese team is that I feel like their playbook wasn't big enough and therefore there was no room for them to improvise, which meant that, you know, on probably 8 attacks on each half, Arledge and Nicholas were just doing a straight switch off first phase because they didn't simply have enough that they could do that they could revolve different moves around and make more stuff on the spot, which they would be able to now.
And
so,
I think a really interesting point as well on Japan is that I think rugby has caught up with what suits Japanese rugby.
Yeah.
In that you go back to like the 80s and you watch Japan scoring tries and it's all set piece based and they do a lot of running really interesting complicated moves that are pre-rehearsed. And that's what they kind of turned into, only it wasn't just pre-rehearsed moves. Every single phase, they kind of had a plan for. And it was so structured and organised. And it felt like a new way to play rugby. You know, it felt like they took a handful of ideas that people had used before and they transformed it into this incredible new thing that worked so efficiently. And Ireland and Scotland had no real way of dealing with it. And the Springboks only did because they were exactly what we're saying. They were so good at the staples of rugby, you know, traditionally. And Japan kind of always looked a bit like that. Yeah, and rugby itself has turned into a very kind of organised and structured game. And so hence why analysis is far more important now. And hence why, you know, every position is kind of unifying,
I guess. It's such an imperative thing that every team knows exactly what they're doing several phases down the line. Whereas this Japanese team with Tanaka playing 9 with Hawassa coming off the bench, like every time they were getting such quick ball. And they had the exact same problem in the France game earlier in the tournament, that when it got to second or third phase, they'd kind of think, oh no, what do we do with this now? We've not planned for retaining the ball for this many phases, you know?
Yeah. The thing that I really enjoy seeing now, kind of looking back at how it's all evolved, was I still picked out, maybe there's a little bit of bias in terms of knowing that these guys went on to be really good players, but Stroke to Holly had one of absolutely awesome game. Like, his ball handling skills were so clearly above everyone else in the pack.
Yeah.
Then you had Luke Thompson, who was fantastic in the line out, kind of opposition line out, doing his job. And then you had Leach, who, looking a lot younger than he looked.
Yeah.
And just those three were the backbones of the forward pack in 2015 and in 2019.
Mm.
And you can see that they are, you know, maybe not so much Thompson, but they're kind of like a step above, just in terms of the skill level is so much higher than the rest of the forwards.
So I want to pick up on this. This is a point I've got jotted down that I want to talk about, because I think Luke Thompson is going to go down as one of the most underrated players of all time.
Absolutely.
And people will look at him as, you know, an Australian who couldn't hack it for Australia, so he went over to Japan. Or they'll look at, you know, Japan only picked him because he was tall and he was a good lineup operator. And people won't realise that actually, I don't think another player, well, the only other player who has transitioned and shown the growth and change in the second row position as precisely between 2007 and 2019 is Alan Wynne-Jones. I think Luke Thompson is second only to Alan Wynne-Jones in that. I think he's an absolutely phenomenal player, and he's adapted and changed his game as he went. And he was pretty much the model of what you'd want a second row to be in each era. Admittedly, he was a bit slow in 2019. He wasn't as pacey as perhaps you'd want from, you know, a lot of the Itojis of the world, or the Harjay Snymans.
He had to make up for it, though.
Exactly. He did.
He could throw 20 metre lift pass if he wanted to.
The sheer organisation and awareness. I've seen very few locks with the rugby intelligence that he had.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the other thing is that people talk about him as this kind of mercenary or whatever. And he wasn't, you know, he moved over to Japan when he was like 21. I think he was 19. He went on an exchange year when he was at uni. And he stayed there, you know, he married a local. And when I was in Hanazono last year during the World Cup for the Georgia-Fiji game, because he's, you know, that's where he's grown, that's where he's lived. That's where he went to uni, that's where he's lived since. And he's played for the local team. And like they had a framed jersey of him in town, and they had banners up just saying "Go, you know, Luke-san, Thompson-san, you know, this like local legend." And there were posters of him everywhere, and people loved him. You know, he'd really bought into the local community, and he'd been really respected back. And they thought he was magnificent, and he was. And like when we watched back, just to keep on my Luke Thompson tirade, we watched back over the course of lockdown the Springboks, the Brighton Miracle game, and it was amazing because you'd spent years thinking it was Michael Leach and it was Goromaru and it was Fumi Tanaka
with
standout players.
Yeah.
Watching it back, Luke Thompson was the best player on the pitch. Like, and I don't think it's close.
He was effectively playing as a second fly half, which is unheard of for a second row. Because when you look at a second row in 2015, you're looking for certain things. But looking at it 4 years, well, 5 years later, you suddenly realise how far that position's changed.
Yeah.
When you didn't, you can't realise how much a second row can change. Because obviously, as you were saying a minute ago, Sam, that in this game, he very much caught his lineouts, hit his rucks, carried when he needed to. There was one point where he did a one-handed pickup, and I thought, oh, that's where he's developing, this boy.
Yeah.
But you're right, like, you wouldn't think there was that much room for change in the second row position, but that aged so differently watching that game back.
Yeah. Like, there's I've just got a couple of moments from him in this game, in the Tonga-Japan game. Just like, he's the only person I've ever seen stop Tamalolo dead in his tracks. Tamalolo's on a bit of a charge. Thompson just stops him, drops him. He's got this incredible take he takes from kickoff, where he charges in suddenly out of nowhere and rips it out of the guy about to catch its hands, like arms outstretched, dives, rolls forward, like roly-polies. He smashes someone another kickoff into touch. Consistently very good at the line-out, steals a couple. He wins a breakdown turnover. There's all sorts of just... I think he's absolutely brilliant. And I just wanted a moment to reflect on Luke Thompson, one of the most underrated players of all time, who died this week, age 40. No, no. but Luke Thompson, really good rugby.
He's that backbone, the Holley Thompson Leach. It's, we talk a lot about the back row, trying to work out how to get the perfect back row, and you know, get a bit of carrying here, but you sacrifice a bit of mobility. Those three, although they're not obviously back row players, they have that perfect kind of pivot in that you have Holley, who functions in this game and most games as like an eight back with his ball handling, and obviously with their 1-3-2-2 formation kind of sent out onto the wing to do that job. And then you have Leach, who basically does everything, but probably his best strength is that ball carrying and then just mopping up with tackles.
Yeah.
and again, Japan sent him out onto the wing to do that job. And there was just something brilliant about watching him take a big old miss pass and just charge at some poor, unsuspecting winger. And then you have Thompson, who basically, this is accidentally turning into quite a good analogy, in that you have those two on the outside, and he basically does everything else that's in the middle of those two.
Yeah.
And it does show that if you have those pieces, you can kind of build a team around them, because you don't need exceptional players in every single position. You just need star players who can carry a burden and make life easier for everyone else.
Yeah, it's the backbone analogy, isn't it? You know, people talk about something being the backbone of a team, but actually, if you're to look at that, break down what that analogy is, you've got certain players and the rest is just meaty flesh on there to fill up numbers, you know, fill out so you can walk around.
Exactly. The one thing I do want to pick up on again about tactics is there's a point at the start where the Australian commentator says, Tonga want to play fast, exciting rugby. No, they don't. There's this constant Pacific Island kind of stereotype that you look at Tonga and you look at Fiji and you go, well, they look a bit similar. They play exactly the same way. Tonga in the last World Cup were the most, if what you like is passes per buck and not kicking, the most boring team in the World Cup. They barely pass it per buck, and they kick an absolute shit ton.
Yeah.
And the people just stick this lazy label of like, well, they're Pacific Islanders, so they all play the same. They all play one-legs and, you know, play from anywhere. But Tonga could not like that.
The way Tonga played against England in particular, where they shut it down, it was the equivalent of parking the bus in football, just knocking it around your back free. It was so boring. Kurt Marath, who here, weirdly, both doesn't look younger. Like, his face shape hasn't changed at all, but there's no wrinkles.
Oh, let me see. How old was he in 2011?
Oh, he was 46. might be 47.
Yeah, he's only 35 now.
I don't believe it. His profile in ESPN Scrum as well is a really young-looking lad with, like, Beatles hair. Actually, I don't believe that ever happened. I don't believe there was ever a young, promising youngster called Kirk Stanley Marath. Of course his middle name's Stanley. Of course he's got the most bog-standard, slightly boring, but in a unique way, middle name.
His Wikipedia picture actually makes him look like a Madame Tussauds.
So does some of his play in last World Cup.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's kind of it. He is, the Tongan team are hardy waxworks that get kind of shoved into contact, and then that's really it. I mean, Vaiakolo had some exciting moments. And they are the good side in this World Cup.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
I do think that people probably need to put away the lazy stereotype that Tonga are this exciting Pacific Island.
Yeah.
It's worth noting, like, the only try up to the, you know, in this World Cup so far, Tonga have had scored by a back, I think. Oh, no, there was one by Siali Piatau and then one Siali Piatau and Fetu Vainikola, the only backs to score try. They've had more tries through their forwards.
Yeah, yeah. And they're such a direct team at this point, and really the majority of the Tongan game plan in this game was revolving around the scrum, which had Siwani Tongawea and Falfolise both playing at the top level in Europe at this point. And on the bench, they had Sone Tamalolo and Halani Aluka. Again, high-profile players. Why wouldn't you base your game plan around them?
Yeah.
And just to briefly touch on Falise, because, you know, if I could touch Falise right now, I would. But
feel blessed.
Yeah. Can we just talk about the moment when Tau Falise becomes the arch playmaker and sets up a try for Loloka Tui?
It's exactly what you'd expect from Tau Falise, who is, of course, one of the all-time great playmaking props. And, of course, one of the all-time great rugby players. You know, there was actually talk shortly after this game of the All Blacks, obviously, because not long after this, Dan Carter goes uninjured. And there was talk of whether or not it would be okay for them to call up Tau Falise for him to play 10 for New Zealand.
You know, I always had this thing, right, that before Falise retired, and it's still possible, but I always thought that Falise hasn't played for Tonga in long enough that he could re-qualify for Wales by playing 4-7s tournaments and get a Welsh cap. And I just really want that to happen.
I could see him in sevens. It'd be a lot of fun.
It'd be glorious. Yeah.
It's, you remember that one try he scored against Toulouse where he ran like 30 yards off Sam Norton? Yeah. He's glorious. Sorry, Sam.
No, I was just going to say, we almost, there was almost a makeshift Sam Norton night on that, but it didn't. We only got as far as Sam Norton. I get the full night, so he doesn't appear in our bedroom later.
You mentioned him three times. He appears and knocks the ball on from the 10 position.
The Tongan scrum really does take apart Japan until the second half when they make substitutions and somehow Japan look completely rejuvenated. It's
That's honestly, I think, the turning point of the game, really. It was, I know obviously Japan don't quite get into it, you know, but, and also, I mean, Tonga were blessed with the fact that James Arlager just spent 10 minutes in the sin bin, which took so much sting out of the Japanese attack. But well, half-time, change.
There's this interesting thing of, while James Arlager's in the sin bin, Fumi Tanaka's still taking quick taps at every opportunity.
Yes.
And I can't work out whether the thing to do is to slow the game down or to try and really commit to, like, no, this is the way we play, we're going to do this.
Well, can I say, so the James Arlage yellow card, not a yellow card, quite clearly onside,
is
a long time after the ball's been played.
Because the ball's in the scrum half's hands, but it hasn't left, like, it's still behind the back foot of the ruck, so it becomes one of those where you've got to stop and go, wait, no, hold on, because if he is offside, it's clearly a yellow card, because he's absolutely killed the play, but it's a... Basically, for those that haven't seen it, he runs in and takes an intercept when he's possibly offside, when Tonga otherwise have numbers and would have scored.
Oh, definitely, yeah. So that's a good point. When I saw that, I thought the ball had bobbled and was out the back and was then picked up, and it was at that point that he came out of the line. But he had a great game, Arlage, I thought. Maybe not great, a very good game.
Yeah.
Distributing, and him and Nicholas formed quite a good pairing. But when he was off in a sin bin, Sean Webb, bless him, didn't have a great 10 minutes. Kind of a standing fly half. He hadn't had a great game up till then. There was one moment where he kind of quite scaredly kicks the ball out of his 22 when he just fly hacks it out when
they've
just dived on it.
Makes about 6 meters.
Yeah,
I don't think you've quite done that justice. Yeah, there's quite a good kick by Tonga. Endo, the Japanese winger, covers it, and he hurls the ball about 13 feet over Webb's head, and it looks like he's trying to pass to someone outside Webb.
It looks like
he's
over the crossbar.
Yeah, like he's. It's nowhere near. Like, it isn't like he's trying to pass to Webb and he just misses slightly. He chucks it, like, his head's high over his head. Webb then, instead of diving on it or picking it up and trying to kick it or anything else, he just tries to fly hack it about 10 metres. It's horror. It's terror. It's, like, automatic dick of the day qualification.
It looks like his attitude's kind of like, well, if the ball's not in my hands, it's not my problem. And just boots it, like, 10 metres away at most.
It's like kids rugby in that the ball's there and no one is quite brave enough to dive on it.
Yeah.
And it is awful. But that's also, like we say at the start, it's quite Japanese in like the best kind of Japan that we've seen recently. But also there's no execution. So it's like, the idea is very, very kind of modern Japan rugby, but the execution is very 2011.
Yes. It bothers me that he had time to pick that ball up. It wasn't like there was someone hearing down him. He could have picked it up and probably still got like a bit of a clearance in or stood his ground. But like he doesn't. And it's like, mate, you're playing for, I suppose not your country, you're playing for a country. But this is a World Cup.
Yeah.
Dive on the ball, like show some sort of, if people can do this playing, you know, for like Barnstable thirds against Jerry Collins.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Then you can do it playing for Japan. Admittedly, they weren't playing against Tonga for Barnstable, but I don't know. It's an incredible moment of shitness. Were we talking about the scrum? Did we move on past the scrum?
The only thing I was going to say about Sean Webb is in the yellow card period, he receives the ball, he can put it out of play, the game's the half's over, and he lofts a high ball into still in his own half, no one's really chasing, I think, because everyone else is going, well, clearly Sean's going to stick this into the stands, because why would we do anything other than that when we're down 40 men in our own 22 at the end of the half? So he sticks this high ball down. No one really chases it. It's caught, I think it's caught by Molaf, or maybe Pieter, who for some reason, instead of attacking, again, the game situation's the same. You're up a man, you're in the Japan half. He just looks at it, goes, you know, maybe this is what a fortunate blessing we have here. And just does exactly the same kick, which Webb marks. Although, I don't even know if he does mark it. I think Dave Pearson just goes, mate, for God's sake, you've marked this, just stop. And then they do get out
of
play.
And he tells him to kick the ball out as well. He says, yeah, you've got the mark, just kick it out.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, like, after he calls the mark, Sean Webb just goes for a little walk.
Yeah.
Like, he catches the ball, calls the mark, Dave Pearson awards him the mark, and he just starts wandering off. And everyone's kind of like, mate, what are you doing? Why are you just walking 10 metres away? Just on a casual little stroll through the park.
Yeah, and then he comes back, and then he's told to kick it out.
And he is told to kick it out. It's a simply remark-worthy performance by Sean Webb, I think. Should we talk a bit about the Tonga team? Because I don't think we've...
Sure, yeah.
Or actually, I think a good point to pick up on Tonga is, so from the very kickoff, right, Japan taking the kickoff, and about 5 seconds into the game, they try to run it from their own try line. At which point, Kikitani picks a great line that would have put him straight through, but he can't take the pass. They knock it on, just as you were saying, Sam, about, you know, the execution. And Tonga regather the ball. Tonga then keep hold the ball until 9 minutes 28.
Wow.
Which is the next time a Japanese player has the ball in their hands.
Wow, that's incredible. There's also, on the inverse of what happened with James Arledge, about, I think it's like 35 seconds into the game, Luke Thompson doesn't roll away and gives what is very clearly a yellow card offence and just totally gets away with it. And he just gives a scrum, which eventually, to be fair, leads to Viliame Mahaffy's try. Mm. But I guess Japan accumulatively had a yellow card coming.
They were lucky to only get one, really, after that, after that start. There was so much pressure, and they were so consistently offending pretty much the same way. One thing I did like, or that I thought was quite funny, was when Pierre Chow makes that break out of his own half.
Yes.
There's no one back, and it's a brilliant break. Mm-hmm. But he's clearly going to get chased down by, weirdly enough, Leach, I think.
Yeah.
It's
Michael Leach.
Chased down, and Pierre Chow is looking, you know, he's holding the ball, and he's looking for offload, and he doesn't get it away. And I think, you probably could have tossed it over the top of Leach or...
grubber kick, I was thinking.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That would have worked as well, because Leach was clearly coming across to him so that everyone else could have just kicked it away from him. But he doesn't decide to do any of that. And then I think, okay, fair enough. He's made the break. They're going to score the second phase because, you know, he's clearly decided that the offload is too dangerous to try. Then he gets tackled and then tries a completely mad, never in a million years was it on offload, that goes straight to Engo, I think. And you just think, well, you showed some circumspect there to not throw the infield offload. Did that just run out? Like you just exhausted that and then thought, what I'm going to do is throw some ridiculous one-handed offload. And they get turned over. They then return it back over, which is...
He was playing initially off instinct. Then you remember the commentators wanted Tonga to play fast, exciting rugby. So he went, oh, better throw this offload then. Never mind.
Yeah.
The really remarkable bit about that break that you mentioned is, as you say, he's chased down by Michael Leach. Yeah. Right? I watched it on the replay. Pieter Tau takes the ball 5 metres or, you know, 2 or 3 metres plus the angle ahead of Michael Leach, who chases down an outside centre.
Yeah.
Hounds him, catches him.
I think 5 metres is generous to Pieter Tau. I think Leach does a bit more than that.
Oh, yeah. Probably with the angle is 10 metres.
Yeah.
Leach chases him down, like, and it takes, you know, over 70 metres, over from 22 to 22. As I say, Tonga then turned the ball back over, as you mentioned, Sam. And then they fire it on, you know, and the first phase after Tonga turned it back over, Michael Leach gets over the ball and wins it back for Japan. And wins the breakdown turnover. It's one of the most remarkable moments of open side flanker play you'll ever see.
Yeah. it is a stunning bit of chasing, because when you watch it the first time, you think what's happened is that maybe Leach is injured, or he was playing in the backfield or something, and he's just come across and made the tackle. But then when you watch it back, you think, hang on, he was attacking just seconds before. It's incredible. I mean, he also does that when Vanacolo almost scores in the corner, Leach comes charging across, makes the tackle, and then I think it's Endo, it could be Onozawa. Makes a brilliant clearing kick from kind of but they were really scrambling defensively, Japan, which is something they've continued to do since then. They've got more effective at it, but they really did put up a good fight to not be further behind in this game.
It's remarkable that Leach twice manages to make try-saving tackles to make the player offload to one of his wingers. It's a very obscure skill.
Onozawa, just to mention him, I heard this mentioned during the game, and I went and checked this. He has two nicknames, which I think are two very fine and unusual nicknames in rugby. One of which is the Eel, which is the more usual of the two, because he's slippery, I guess.
Sure.
Eli Walker, similar nickname for similar reasons, also because his name was Eel Eye. His other nickname, however, which is most often translated in Japanese, is Rubber Man, which is, of course, named after One Piece, the anime, which I think makes him the only player in this World Cup with a nickname after an anime.
So, just to get this straight, the All Blacks will have probably had a team huddle at one point and gone, lads, the guy who just scored against us, his nickname's after an anime.
Yeah.
The hell are we doing?
But Monkey D. Luffy scored against us. What are we doing? Actually, you know, he could probably just reach all the way around because he's got like those rubber arms, hasn't he? I'm running out of One Piece knowledge. I just know it's about a stretchy boy.
You lost me at anime, to be honest.
Yeah. This is a film podcast. Why aren't we talking about, like, a bit of Ghibli?
That's a good point.
Sam, favourite Studio Ghibli film? Go.
I've only seen one.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Apologies in advance. I can't remember which one it is. I think it's...
Okay.
What's the one with the bathhouse?
The bathhouse, that would be Spirited Away.
Yeah, that one.
Though I think Howl's Moving Castle might have a bathhouse as well, but Spirited Away, which is great. Spirited Away.
Spirited Away, yeah. I liked it. I should go back and rewatch them. I'm not a massive animation fan, if I'm honest.
No?
No. Well, I like, what do I like that, the sound made? I do like Lion King, the original one.
Yeah.
I also like Toy Story.
Yes.
And Toy Story 2 and Toy Story 3.
Yeah.
All good.
Toy Story 4. Good.
But
no, Toy Story 4.
I will die on the hill that Toy Story 4 is great.
I've not even seen Toy Story 4.
It's good.
I'm just so worried. It took me so long to build up to watching Toy Story 3 because I was so worried it was going to be absolutely awful. In fact, I watched
Toy Story 3 is the best of the lot.
It probably is, actually.
I couldn't rank them.
I struggled with my Toy Story 3. Yeah. But I really like 4 as a... It's more an epilogue than an ending.
Yeah. I liked it, but nowhere near as much as the first three.
Mm.
Well, that's a problem. So I think that about... Because The Hobbit came back on TV.
Right.
Do you think that The Hobbit is rubbish because we've seen Lord of the Rings? Or is it rubbish because it's rubbish?
Well, I think it's rubbish. If it's rubbish because of Lord of the Rings, that would require Lord of the Rings to itself be worth watching. I realise I may have lost what audience we have, but I am. It's a lot of waiting around for people looking at eagles. You know, it's a lot of just nonsense. I've never been I've pissed off so many people instantly because I can't ever launch it because I know it's just I don't click with it. You know.
Do you not like any kind of fantasy stuff like that? Or
I know I'm less inclined towards it, and I couldn't tell. I think I'm
neither
less
of us like
towards...
Game of Thrones, if that answers your question.
I've never watched Game of Thrones.
Oh, do you not? Have you not?
No.
I have, and I didn't like it. I watched the first five episodes and couldn't get into it.
But
which
I just
people
like,
crucify me for. But...
Part of the thing I like about films, right, is that you come in and you got, like, in 2 hours, you've found out all you need to know about this world and you're done. I find it often quite hard when, and I've got slightly less patience when I've got to learn the rules of a world and it takes more than 2 hours to do so, you know?
Yeah.
I'm fine with, I saw Tenet yesterday and I'm fine with that because it's like, okay, these are the rules of the world. fine, they're complicated, but I can follow them in that time period. Whereas instead it's like, oh, you've got to go and read these 17 books, and then you've got like the Silmarillion, and you've got, oh, I don't know. Never mind.
The thing that really pissed me off about quite a lot of Netflix and stuff, like, you know, box set stuff that's on there, it's two things. First one is, I remember I watched the first episode of the XO or the OA or the...
And there was Britt Robertson, another one, yeah. No, not Britt Robertson, Britt Marling, sorry.
Maybe. It was like a TV series recently.
Yeah.
It had Hello to Jason Isaacs in it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Is that one? Yeah. We're thinking the same program.
Yeah. And I watched the first episode of that, and what happens with a lot of these kind of mystery type things is that the first episode is someone walking into a room where someone's having a conversation, and then the person stops having the conversation. Or someone goes into a building, and it's never explained why they're in the building. Or someone like opens a box and looks suspiciously or scaredly or whatever at the box and closes it. And you're sat there going, I've sat for an hour of this. I've got absolutely no idea what's going on. And you're confused, like intrigue for just confusion. Like it wouldn't be an intriguing book if you just went, so-and-so said, and then George said this, and then you just blanked out what he said. Yeah. Like, that's not mysterious. That's just incredibly infuriating and annoying. And the second thing that annoys me about those things is when someone says, oh, yeah, the first series is a bit slow, but it picks up after that. And you think the first series is 24-hour-long episodes. I'm not going to sit through a whole day of my life watching something that, by your own admission, and you're the fan, is quite hard to get into.
Yeah, that's the other thing that always get, you know, when people say, oh, you've got to watch the third series. I'm not going to do that. I'm not. I don't care. Or even the opposite of Game of Thrones is like, yeah, it's really good. And then the ending's shit.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, what's the point?
Yeah. Well, there's so many of those where you think, ooh, great first series. Great second series. Third series was on the wane. Fourth series was actively poor. And then the fifth series is woeful. Like, I have a friend who watched entirely of Lost, and he hates it because he couldn't stop because he invested so much time into the good bits that he just absolutely despises it, like the last couple of series where they just clearly phoned it in.
Yeah, I likewise have a friend who watched all... This isn't... Never mind. Let's not compare our friend's notes on Lost. This is what people have tuned in for. Who's got
You're
a mate that watched all of Lost?
World Cup retrospective, where we talk about Tonga against Japan from the 2011 Rugby World Cup.
Exclusively. Nothing
I can do a little bit more on this.
Okay, go on, please.
Okay.
A little bit more notes. So, first thing, there were 12 Japan handling errors after 1 hour.
Wow.
Christ.
But I think that's indicative of how they're trying to play, isn't it? Because they're too ambitious for their skill level.
Yeah, it definitely was. Also, though, in context, they'll be after what you said about they didn't touch it for basically the entire first 10 minutes. Means they only had 50 minutes to back up 12 handling errors.
That's insane.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Also, the ability with which both sides managed to completely mess it up as after they scored a try. The number of times that Japan either scored a try or got a penalty and then messed up the restart, or Tonga scored a try and then messed up the restart. I mean, it was, there were elements, it was a good game because it was scrappy. It wasn't necessarily what you'd show to a team to say, well, this is how we want to play.
Yes, yeah. It's a game you show to someone who's thinking about watching the World Cup, but not someone who's thinking about getting into rugby.
Yeah. Yeah. But both the first two tries, there's Mahfouz's try and then Hatsakayama's try, both come from kickoffs that the other team have just completely fluffed. And like Hatsakayama scores his try where the commentators are convinced it's a double movement. And Hatsakayama like gets up and then he looks like he's convinced himself. He's like, oh, that was a try.
I thought it was a double movement.
Yeah, I think it was.
But then maybe that's just making up for Arledge's call. You know, it's these things shake out. Karma. Hatsakayama.
Also, Tanaka is actively digging around at the back of the look, trying to find the ball.
Yes.
Planted somewhere near the try line. So it doesn't look like what you would typically expect a try to look like.
Yeah. So you look at the replay and you're thinking like, oh, okay, is this the ball's about to come out, isn't it? Because Tanaka is, as you say, like he's fumbling about for the ball, thinking, where is it? And you don't realise that somebody's just scored next to you. Also, can we just point out that Robbie just spent all of that time when you were talking about that just smirking at his own joke where he said, karma for Hatsakayama. Hatsakayama police.
I thought it was pretty... Uh-huh. Hatsakayama, Yama, 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 Chameleon.
Oh, God.
I halfway through realised I've got to do this. I don't want to read the punchline of this.
Just to breeze past that.
Please.
The thing I really liked about these commentators is they're quite good to listen to. Like, generally, I quite enjoyed it. Mm. But there was a bit near the start where there's quite a clear high tackle by a Tongan player on, I'm not sure who it is, but some Japanese back is kind of trying to get down the outside of this guy and he gets a really high tackle.
Yeah.
And the commentator goes, oh, that looked like a high tackle to me, except in an Australian accent. And then Dave Pearson doesn't do anything. Mm. And the commentator goes, oh, he's waved it on, good refereeing. And you think, it can't be both. Like, it can't. Yeah. Think it's a high tackle, in which case he's made the wrong decision, or you're thinking, great, he's just playing what he sees, in which case it's bad that it's not a high tackle. Like, it can't, you know, can't have that both ways.
And it fits into that category that we're seeing a lot of this World Cup, going back over it, that would be a yellow card now, but, yeah. You know, you've got to let it go because the game was different. And actually, in the week between the last game and this game, or the time in between, referees issued, or the big boss referees issued a statement saying they wanted teams to be, or referees to be more harsh on repeat infringements and on tip tackles, which won't be relevant, and there won't be any tip tackles that are really harshly, just because it was mentioned, you know, it won't be relevant at all in any game. Thanks. Especially not in knockouts.
Okay, let's just not talk about it then.
Yeah. Sam Warburton probably watched this game, having a nice day. He was having a great time, as he would for the rest of the World Cup.
Shush.
Including that finally went on to play in.
He must have been watching Michael Leitch play seven and been getting some lovely tips on how to tackle.
The standard of humour's going down here. Should we talk about Leitch's try that he scored?
Because, sure.
I mean, he wasn't having a good enough game already up to that point. We're about 20 minutes in. And for the record, there's a period, if anybody does decide to rewatch this game, if you're stripped for time, maybe start at about 10-15 minutes in and go till about the 30th minute, because that is where both teams just go totally batshit. That's when that Leitch tackle happens. There's Onozawa makes a lovely break, which Sean Webb Vungalila then takes him around the ankles. Then Nicholas makes a break on the switch, which leads to Leitch's try. And it was probably Endo, I think, gave the pass back inside, and Leitch, it didn't look like he was really positioned to finish it, but he takes that so well. He finishes it like an outside centre would.
The way he rides the tackle and manages to get the ball down is genuinely an incredibly impressive finish.
Yeah, it's a great build-up as well, because there's kind of options, and you compare it to Pietau's break where no one really gave him many options to pass to, and in Felicia's strikes, it's much more kind of clear-cut, like Japan are clearly getting players into positions to have multiple options either side.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, there's also Tupaeli makes a break himself. And the thing is, to again, briefly just talk about Tupaeli, it's very strange because I feel like this is a very open game, which weirdly suits a centre like him, who is quite rangy. Not rangy, he's big, but and can sort of offload, but can't do anything else. Like, he doesn't have much of a skill set. He really struggles catching the ball. And there's a couple of points where you think, oh, if it was Marnoni there, he'd have put that in behind.
Or
and...
just a centre who could pass.
Yeah. Sure, yeah.
If and it was someone really playing like under-15s rugby at 12.
Yeah, it's really frustrating watching him because this game is so nearly perfectly crafted for him. Mm. And yet, he just lets himself down on so many occasions by just lazily, you know, not running the right line or dropping the ball just before the defensive line or whatever. Yeah, he makes a break and then which then leads to Sean Webb throwing a dummy and not quite scoring himself.
Mm.
Yeah, no, Tupaielli is infuriating to watch, frankly,
because he's good enough to be frustrating.
Yeah,
it's not like he's just shit. He just he can't pass. He doesn't have a round of that skill set. And there's a few points. You know, there's a point Sam you mentioned in the second half where they tried to play out of the zone 22. And if he throws a decent pass, Endo has at least quite a good run down the wing.
Yeah.
But instead he just drops it behind him, you know, because it's a really difficult pass for him to take. It's not sympathetic at all because he's struggling because it's off his wrong hand. It's just let's just say he's good enough to be... You see where someone will pick him up, but he's not... His skill set isn't good enough for this level. Yeah.
What I find quite interesting is when you look... Because it's hard to watch these games without then thinking, well, you know, what happens next?
Yeah.
And when you think about those, think about what happened next. You took Tupaielli. You replace him this year or last year with Lafayette, and they're pretty much the same height, and but there's about 20 kilograms difference between them. But you see the huge upsurge in skill level there.
Yeah.
And that Lafayette has got an unbelievable offload and great passing and just
kick,
yeah. And can just he kind of brings that back line together. If he was in this 2011 side, you've got Arledge who is really good. Like it's a good tank. You've got Nicholas who had a storming game, and then you put Lafayette there. You've just had so many more options to move that ball wide and to put people into space. And Japan just didn't have that. And you could see that told in a few parts where they put themselves under pressure by not being able to exit, which passing to exit is fantastic. Like, more teams should do that because there's so much space.
Yeah.
But they just didn't have the skill set to execute that. And you can see that there's quite a few people who are essentially kind of upgrades of the 2011 players. Like, you look at Himeno and Kikutani, and Kikutani has a decent game, but they, even down to like the same lifting tape, they incredibly similar style of player.
Yeah. Mm. I always considered Himeno to be the direct midpoint between Kikutani and Leach as a youngster in the Japanese back row.
Yeah.
I just think Jimeno's the most rounded back row I've seen come through in a long time. He can do everything. And he's also, he's built in such a way that he could convincingly play anywhere across that. And he has played everywhere across that back five. You know, he's capped a second row, seven, and obviously played six and eight during the World Cup.
Yeah,
I rate Kazuki Jimeno impossibly highly.
Yeah.
And I also enjoy the fact that he started tweeting videos and playing rugby 20 on his own. He's got like a really fancy gaming chair as well, because of course he has.
it's a great game to watch, just to see if I were you know, the USA or Canada or something, I would just love to watch this game and then say Japan Samoa or Japan Russia, you know, wherever for 2019, and go, okay, well, how do we get from there to and it's actually not that complicated, you know. I mean obviously behind the scenes, it's vastly complicated to get players up to that level and all that kind of stuff. But in terms of style of play, you just need to upskill everyone, which is clear. Like, that's the difficult thing to do, but you can't really skip that bit. You have to upskill.
Yeah.
But then you also have to kind of decide how you're going to play the game. And like we spoke about before, Japan were playing in the mold of every other team, despite the fact that their play didn't really suit that. When they escaped from that, that's when they really became the kind of the elite team that they are now.
I actually I think you picking the USA and Canada is a really interesting pair of examples because those countries are both so big and so varied. And I know Canada in particular has real problems trying to get a united team together and trying to get the teams to train. And so much of how Japan were able to improve was that Eddie Jones and Jeremy Joseph were both given almost complete access to their players.
Yeah.
And part of that also comes from the fact that they have a really well-developed domestic league. So basically their entire team played. You know, you look at this team, it's only Kikutani that doesn't play in Japan. And likewise, you look at, you know, it was...
Arledge as well.
When, oh, yes, Arledge, of course, yeah. Just coming from the Dragons. And you look at, you know, 2 years ago when Joseph's first beginning to build for a World Cup, it's just Fumi Tanaka, and then I guess Michael Leach was still at the Chiefs at the time, wasn't he? But he comes back as well in order to prepare for this World Cup. So again, you've got 30-odd of your squad there, and you're able to bring them together and train and unite. And, like, it's a bullshit point, but I also think it is relevant that Japan has really good public transport systems. That, you know, they have the world's best public transport, as you will have experienced as well, Sam, out there last year. So you're able to quite easily get from one side of the country to the next, you know, in a day. It's not a problem to unite this squad, whereas Canada and the USA don't really have that advantage and weren't able to bring together and build a team over the course of a year in the way Eddie Jones and Jamie Joseph were, through just having the sheer time and ability. And MLR will help with that. You know, players being contracted to play in America and in Canada will help a lot. But it's the beginnings of something, you know.
I've just had a thought on the basis of what you're just saying, Sam, about skill level, that it's quite a lazy thing, obviously, to say, like, oh, everyone can handle the ball now. But thinking about it, for example, like, to pick out a couple of players in the Japan team last year, for example, like Nakajima and Ivalu, who are the replacement props for Japan, I would genuinely wager that their ball handling was probably better than Tupaioli and Nicholas, who had a centre partnership in 2011. And that's insane because, you know, they are, you know, whether it's training or a match, they're given so many more touches of the ball per, you know, 40-minute period or whatever than those centres would have in this time. And that's just crazy to think. Like, that's a pair of replacement props.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when I was in Tokyo, we had... The office I was in was next door to a high school, and they had like their I guess training facilities. It was just like mud, basically, kind of hard packed mud, but just open out onto the street. So one lunch, I just grabbed some food and was sat there watching their rugby training session, and it was interesting to see because they were really heavily working on just skill level. I didn't see them play. Even the times I just kind of walked past and just kind of had a look and see what they were doing, they weren't playing touch or anything like that. They were just doing drills, which I kind of thought was odd because the Japan game, if any kind of team in world rugby suits just playing touch all the time, then kind of Japan is that. But also you could see how much focus they were putting on that skill level. And obviously you can read too much into one school and how they do it, but it kind of felt a bit at odds to how Japan were playing and that they were trying to be really structured in this school training session. But clearly they are structured, but...
A different way.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Structure.
I think Japan, because they're a big passing team, people assume that all passing teams are Fiji, you know, and it is improvised. And I think actually Japan is really pre-set out, and just because they keep hold of the ball, but not in the way Ireland keep hold of the ball and Joe Smith would, you know, and it was phase after phase after phase, and they were very much just crashing up after one or two passes. Japan, they will chuck it about, but they know what they're doing before the ball leaves the ruck.
Like, I would also imagine that a lot of that whole thing about them doing loads of drills as like a coaching point is that in a drill like that, each player can touch the ball 5 times in a minute, whereas when you play a game of touch, you'll maybe get it twice. And it's such a key point that coaches focus on these days is giving players loads of touches of the ball, you know, loads of chances to practice your passes or your catch or whatever, simple skills. So I imagine that's probably something to do with it.
Go on.
No, I was just going to say, I definitely agree. I think that's how Japanese rugby sustains itself beyond Hawley, Leach, Thompson, is that you need those players coming up. But also you need to keep that skill level high because realistically, unless something vastly different happens, you're going to end up with quite a lot of smaller people that, you know, if you don't want to keep kind of going to Australia and New Zealand and seeing if you can pick up kind of locks from there, your game is going to be like this for ever, really.
Yeah.
But I think I can see the second row position evolving to a place in which is less important being incredibly tall. Like, it was still, obviously, there will still be Devin Toners and there will still be players like Luke Charters who are there as line-out specialists. But I can see it getting to a place in which someone like Jimeno could stand out as a second row forward, despite, you know, he's tall enough rather than being exceptionally tall. But because he's got the complete skill set, you know, he has the skill set of a James Ryan or a Mauro Itoje. If not better. There you go, I said it. Jimeno is better than Mauro Itoje. Done.
Correct. Agreed.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that I would disagree. Or certainly, I wouldn't too heavily. I mean, the problem is, a lot of the problem we have with Japanese rugby, and to be honest, I mean, with the semi-Langdragdra thing that's going on at the moment, the not seeing people gives them both a massive mystique and also we completely forget about them. In that, I don't think, if before the 2019 World Cup, anyone would have said Holle could be the best hooker in the world or is certainly in the mix, people have gone, not a chance. Like, that's the
game. I don't know. I've always rated him, I think after this World Cup, I rated him incredibly highly. But I know exactly what you're saying.
People would leap to, I would say that you would have people, and I'm talking about not the uber nerds here, but you would have people talking Dane Coles, Jamie George, probably, and
the two South African hookers, the Mbanambi and Marks.
Yeah, you'd have those all ahead of before Holle was even considered. I think. And so I think that's kind of happened with Japanese rugby, is it's out of the way. No one really watches it until they're in international games, and it's easy to forget that those guys are, they got to a World Cup quarterfinal and didn't lose in their pool despite playing Ireland and Scotland. And they are the elite, and so some of those guys do have to come into the mix.
Yeah.
And I think it works the opposite way with Langdragdra, where people don't only see him very briefly at his best and extrapolate wildly to where they think he's at.
William, what do you think of Sammy Rajada?
I very regularly say this. I think Sammy Rajada is the best rugby player in the world.
I'm just gonna very referee strongly. I'm gonna say nothing for the next few minutes.
Okay, this is gonna be fun. Do you want to go first, Will? Make your case.
I think he's insane. I think him playing on the wing for Fiji in the World Cup, when that first happened, I first thought, oh, what are they doing? You want to give him more touch of the ball. But it just shows how adaptable I think he is, because he didn't play necessarily as a wide player, but still works in that sense because he's so strong and so quick. And like watching Bristol on Tuesday night, which would have been last week as this episode goes out, the way that he can beat a player when he has no right to, I think it kind of weirdly evolves like 2-on-1s as we know it, or 3-on-2s as we know it, because he can take out an extra defender, and just so long as he has somebody to read off him, which granted isn't, something that's guaranteed, I just think he's unplayable at times.
So when I get into the, I want to be very clear, and I think people make the mistake, not you two because you can converse, but I think people make the mistake of, if I'm saying I don't think he's the best in the world, people immediately leap to me saying he's complete dog shit. And to be clear, I don't think that. I think he is in the top five centres in, in the world.
Top half, he's like, there are players worse.
He's better. He's arguably better than me.
Look.
But what I would say is, just from a purely statsy perspective, so again, that same game against Exeter, actually away from the stats, but that game against Exeter, defensively he was kind of found out, and
admittedly, Phil Dolman is also in the top five.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say.
It goes Sam Lana, Phil Dolman, Semi Randrandra, Timothy Lafayette. That's the list.
They can move. Yeah, those listings can be fluid, but they're largely going to stay like that. But I think he was great. That try that Johan Lloyd scored, where he fixed two men and then popped out the back. But when people bring him up as the best in the world, I just go to his ESPN scrum page, and he's played 10 matches for Fiji, and he scored 5 tries, which admittedly is a good return for someone. But three of them...
Kondro Chivanga scored 4 tries in 1 match. Why is he not the best player in the world?
He is. Second.
But he scored 3 tries against Georgia and 1 try against Scotland, which, you know, is questionable which one of those is more valuable.
No, I tell you what, that game against, I was at that game against Georgia. The rain was I couldn't see like the person in the crowd next to me, never mind the actual action on the pitch. The fact that he had the vision to see where the try line was and put the ball down makes it the most impressive try he scored.
Hang on, Sam, you're a Wales supporter too, right?
Yes, I am.
Have you yet recovered from the Wales-Fiji game in the World Cup? Because I haven't.
Not really. That was a very nervous game. Yeah. I loved the small moment of George North's brilliance to putting who was it? Lloyd Williams? Was it Lloyd Williams who scored that try?
Lloyd didn't get, Sanjay scored at the end, the last try.
Oh, what's the one? Was that Georgia where the scrum?
Oh, Thomas Williams scored. Yeah,
was that Fiji?
Was Georgia.
That was Georgia. Oh, yeah.
Well, so it turns out that not only have I got the cover from it, I don't remember anything.
It's PTSD for you.
Yes. Yeah.
He was playing for South Africa.
Yeah.
I hate you. Should we get back onto this game? Do you reckon?
No, I was enjoying this, but fine. You know, I think what we've all learned is that none of these players are as good as Billy Searle. Anyway, so
or Sam Lallana, of course. Cool. So I have a point in my notes where Vinicolo scores a try, and I just have written down Vinicolo brackets fire emoji.
he looked great in this game. He was so kind of steppy and. Yeah. Ball in one hand, kind of just showing off. I really enjoyed watching him, actually. He's one of those people who, because obviously I don't really watch that much Tongan rugby, and he's one of those people I kind of obviously knew about because of his time elsewhere, but he was just so good. Like he just lit it up whenever he got the ball.
Yeah, his acceleration was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Do you want to know 2 fun facts about Fethi Vanikolo?
Yes,
so he goes on to be Tonga's all-time top try scorer. This was his 2nd try.
Yeah.
Which I always think that's really interesting when you kind of see a young player score and you're like, you don't realise this guy's going to go on to be this nation's all-time top try scorer. And as I say, he takes his try so well. Like, it's
unbelievable.
He's got a bit of a gap, you know, he should make some ground from that.
Yeah. Peter helps him out a little bit, but he takes on so much himself.
The other interesting thing about Fethi Vanikolo, and I wish I'd learnt this more than about 5 minutes before we started recording, because otherwise I would have written an accompanying song, is that his middle name is Moana.
Is it?
Like the Disney film.
How far will he go for that try?
Quite. You're welcome for me setting you up there. The try was shiny. I don't know. Yeah, his middle name is Moana, which apparently is a Hawaiian girl's name. So make what you will of that.
Yeah.
But, how did you get that? This might be going beyond your knowledge of him, but how did he get that that name?
Well, he was on a Hawaiian island, or his parents were, when there was this huge crisis, and they sent out on this island where his parents lived. A young girl called Moana to fetch Maui, the demigod. He sang a bunch of songs. You know, he fought a big crab played by Jermaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords, weirdly. And, you know, there was a bunch of stuff. They fought a big, like, demon thing towards the end. And the girl got back. And on the day she got back, a little baby was born. And the dad was like, we should name it Fetu. And the mum said, no, we should name it after Moana, the girl who just saved all our asses. And the dad said, no, that's a girl's name. And she said, are you really that insecure about your masculinity that you won't give your son a girl's name.
Bear in mind, so, Vanicolo is related distantly to somebody whose first name is Leslie, who played for England.
Precisely. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so they compromised. Middle name is Moana. She does not have any powers to control the sea, however.
That's the most I've learned about Moana. I have a thing.
I think what you're trying to say is thank you.
Is. Well, honestly, I could go on and on. I could spend every natural phenomenon, etc.
Sorry, Sam, carry on.
I can do that. That's in my head. That's there.
I was just going to say, I have a thing to you. Has no interest in Thingbubby or anything I do with Thingbubby, but is massively into Disney. And so this will be the.
Finally, they've got this kind of this crossover.
I actually also didn't realise that Leslie and Fetu were related. I could.
They might not be. You know, I might have made that up.
I didn't know that they were related to Maui the demigod.
Maybe that's what I'm confused with. Yeah, I don't know. They might not be related. I think I've maybe made that up.
But it's. It'll probably be one of those things like the Umangas, that there's only a tiny, you know, it comes from one village in one town or one island. Yeah, so the chances are they're distantly related.
I saw Leslie Vianacolo's first ever union game.
Really?
Gloucester versus Cardiff. And it was delayed by traffic on the M4.
Huh.
The full match?
I only got to see the first, maybe, definitely the first half, and maybe only a couple of minutes after that. Before we have to go back to my auntie's for some lamb, I think. It was quite a good game, the half that I saw.
Yeah, that's an image. Just the fact that Leslie Vianacolo has been inconvenienced by traffic on the M4, never thought of that before.
Worcester's team bus broke down on the way to play the Ospreys, and they had to play in the Ospreys training kit.
Didn't they have to play in someone's shorts or someone's top?
Yeah, that was like 2 years ago. That was fairly recently, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Borrow like Glasgow's shorts or something because they got lost.
They might have actually done this twice because they did it in the Principality.
Judgment Day.
Judgment Day, yeah. Because I think someone just forgot to bring the non-Scarlet's top.
Yeah, didn't they have to borrow like WRU shorts or something?
Everyone's tuned in to listen to us discuss who hasn't seen Lost and whether or not someone once wore shorts. But we can't listen live as three white men try to remember if they've seen a man wearing shorts.
I do have a very quick point. Nothing really to do with Bubby. It could even be could be more boring than what we've just been talking about. But did you get annoyed when the phase counter made the clock disappear?
I didn't notice that.
I didn't notice that.
That sounds annoying, though.
The England-Argentina game, but I noticed it in this. I assume it was happening in that game. But when the phase counter came up, it came up at below the scoreline, and it made the clock disappear, which obviously isn't happening now because they've realised they put three things on. But very irritating.
I'd wager the reason why you didn't notice that in the England-Argentina game is because the phase count never got above two. So.
Yeah.
You've got two points of counting. But yeah, that's the only thing that wasn't about basically Japan improved. I kind of didn't really watch Tonga in this game, if I'm honest.
I know what you mean.
I have no, apart from the want to play fast, exciting, lovely bit, which I really, you know, they don't.
And the scrum.
Yeah, everything was about Japan.
Japan were the more interesting thing. So an interesting stat, again, speaking of the things that came up on the scoreboard graphics, is that did anybody see the turnover count, the statistics for that?
No.
Yeah.
Came up towards the end of the game with about 5 minutes to go. Tonga got 8 breakdown turnovers. Right. Japan got 0.
That's not true. That's not true. Is that them being not counting breakdown penalty turnovers?
I don't know. That would make sense, though.
Because Leach won at least two of those. Yeah.
Did he? Okay.
And,
okay.
Yeah.
Which is a bad, like, that's a bad stat.
Yeah, it is. Like if it's a penalty, it's a breakdown turnover. You've won the ball back from a breakdown.
Yeah,
I don't like the. Well, I'm going down a stats rabbit hole here.
Go for it.
I don't like the ESPN stat that says turnovers conceded, but doesn't say turnovers won.
Yes.
Pointless. Just put them both on.
I think we talked about this last time, didn't we? That does that include knock-ons? Does that include
Yeah.
whatever?
Yeah.
You know,
Because it should include... So, if your turnover is conceded, it should include your knock-on. But you shouldn't win a turnover that you've that's being knocked on unless you've caused it with a tackle or something. So, in theory, you could have more turnovers conceded than the turnovers won by the opposition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is interesting to a few people.
That a few people have made it this far into the podcast.
You found two of them, so...
Yeah. Whilst we're on this, I moaned about this on a different podcast, but that, you know, that was another claim to be a rugby podcast. But the BBC graphics for the Six Nations, they had the 22 entries, which is a great stat. Yeah. Really useful to know how many tries and stuff came from 22 entries. And what the BBC did, as if hearing it through like quite a thick wall, they heard this idea from like the hotel room next door, took that, and instead of giving you like a breakdown of what percentage of success they had or whatever, they split it into left, middle, and centre, left, middle, and right, and gave you the amount of 22 entries by each group. Completely pointless statistic.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of rugby stats are taken by, because broadcast coverage of soccer, football, and American football is better than rugby because there's more money in it, often rugby coverage is just copying them rather than actually building it in a bespoke way. And so I don't know if that's something that's more relevant in football, of where, you know, what's the source of the goal? Is it left, right, centre? I don't know. But as you say, that's completely irrelevant.
Yeah. It makes sense that they would have taken that from there, I guess. But
yeah.
Just who cares? Like, you know,
yeah.
Tell us what percentage of attacks resulted in a penalty or some kind of point. Yeah. Like, you don't need to even overcomplicate it by putting some fancy graphics. Just give us a percentage.
Yeah, it's so much more interesting if you make it about like open or blind in relation to where the set piece was or whatever.
Yes,
as opposed to left or right. No one cares about that. That tells you nothing.
Yeah,
and I suppose it's source then, isn't it? Is it
a
succession of rucks? Is it
them
kick?
Going wide straight
is
away?
Is it a break up the middle? Is it wide as you say?
Yeah. See, I'd like that. I'd like so a baseline. I would just want percentage success.
Yeah.
Not even percentage, just 4 out of 12 or whatever.
Yeah.
But then beyond that, you want something like, did they carry it in? Was it a penalty? All that kind of stuff. Like that provides some additional value. I had this debate with Sean Holly.
Oh, really?
About,
did you know?
I was on Under the Sticks. This is actually a different podcast to the one I was mentioning earlier, but we talked about that, and not sure he understood my point. But I was quite keen to suggest that we don't necessarily need more stats, we just need better stats.
Yeah, we need the right stats.
That's fair. I'm very much on your team there, Sam. Don't worry.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm not taking a side for professional reasons. moving along.
I don't have to be professional.
Is every
so I've got one other thing noted down, that there's a really fascinating scrum in the first half where basically both, and it's just, I think you just get a good camera angle, and I could see this happening at other scrums where, but the camera's right on the spot, and it's right near the touchline, where Tonga are clearly going, and I've got written down in my notes, I wish I was David Flatman so I understood what was going on. Because it's a fascinating scrum, because you can clearly tell both sides are going with completely different techniques.
Yeah.
And the scrum ends up kind of both sides fold up because both are applying equal amount of force in completely different ways. So Tonga being very direct and like traditional and kind of smashing forward. And Japan are going in with that kind of low body position, like the sort of sumo style and trying to force up and chase around. I'm sounding like I know what a scrum is.
We have three backs on this podcast and we're talking about scrums.
But yeah, no, I found it fascinating and I just wanted to understand it. It's like how I felt about Tenet yesterday when I saw it. It's fascinating, wish I understood it.
Yeah, I feel that like that about quite a few Christopher Nolan films.
Yeah. Oh, I... Go on.
I was just going to say, now we have the technology, I would just want every scrum to be filmed from like the spider cam angle.
Yeah.
Just downwards looking at what's going on, because I just think you can tell so much more from that than side on, where you can only really see what two people are doing.
You've either got to be exactly side on or spider cam, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's either like, you remember that scrum between, and I talk about this all the time, between England and Argentina a few years ago, where the scrum was so solid and both teams were really going at it and it just didn't move.
Yeah.
And it went on for like 20 seconds of just the scrum being perfectly stationary, but it was the most fascinating moment of rugby.
I would propose instead we have a grass cam, so it's from beneath the scrum, that there's a camera just permanently stationed there in the tunnel on the grass.
Yes. I like it. Do you know who could provide it in the grass?
Go on.
Maui, the demigod.
I was thinking you could get it run in the same way when Ruckley went under the Twickenham turf. He could run it like that and he could have the camera. So yes. I reckon someone should hire Ruckley for some extra work on the side.
I mean, England aren't using him right now.
No.
The RFU, actually, I was looking at this the other day, they've removed the Ruckley page from their website.
Have they?
Yeah, Ruckley's
been
disappeared. Was it
after your email to Sunrise Productions?
This is now a cross-pod thing.
Yeah.
And also a post-crod thing. Which is a cross-word sentence. Yeah, no, I emailed Sunrise Productions, who are the company that made the Ruckley short video. I emailed them live whilst recording episodes of Blood and Mud the other week that I was a guest on. Yes. They never got back to me.
Oh,
anyone was closure on that. They never replied, but yeah. Never mind. It's a real shame. It's a real shame.
Yeah.
I think instead we should go a bit higher and ask Disney Animation Studios to make a sequel to Moana about Fetty Vanicola.
Yeah. And there's got to be a character called Postcard.
Here's a question for you. This is. I haven't asked about this yet, okay. So I'm jumping the ship. Jumping the ship. Is that a word?
Jumping the gun.
Jumping the gun. Yeah, I don't know what jumping the ship would mean, but
jumping the shark. Jump. Yeah.
Jumping is it
all sorts of things?
Brian Moore has recently started cycling.
Okay.
Is it an interesting article to go for a bike ride with Brian Moore and interview him about his rugby life?
I think so. I'd watch, listen to, read that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you should ask if Dmitry Strakov's available to come with you as well.
there would be a complication there, wouldn't it? Where whoever publishes this, it'd be like, okay, I can understand why you're speaking to Brian Moore. I can even understand, though, it's a little bit niche why you would separately be speaking to Dmitry Strakov. Why are you speaking to them both? Which I wouldn't.
Dmitry Strakov in conversation, don't with. I?
Yeah. But yeah,
just get everyone that owns a bike together and they can all have a little cycle around like the Peak District.
That'd be lovely.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, we've got two then. I mean, who else do you really need apart from Brian Moore and Dmitry Strakov?
Is this the official podcast social? Is that we're organizing everybody who owns a bike, which me and Robbie don't.
Yeah.
To go and go for a nice cycle around the Peak District with Brian Moore and Dmitry Strakov.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't help but feel that Strakov would find it infuriating after a while to be, you know, hung around with me and Brian Moore as we cycle the hills of the Peak District.
Do you think if he had another job that wasn't a professional cyclist, he'd cycle to work?
Yeah, I wonder. I wonder, because what happens often when professional cyclists get fat is that it's when they finish, they get fat.
Right.
So maybe he just, when he finishes, and bearing in mind, he's 25, so he maybe he'll just give up. One thing I was just doing then, whilst also trying to speak to you, which I wasn't very good at, was last time I mentioned Chad Plato.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Disappointingly, his numbers of followers haven't gone up as much as I'd have.
Oh, man.
No, they have doubled, I think, since before the podcast went up, which is good.
Yeah, he hasn't tweeted at all. And he has... I actually haven't looked at this before, but he has won the fly. Right? He hasn't made any... This is brilliant. This is the best thing I've ever seen. He hasn't tweeted anything, but he has won the fly, which is just a full stop.
Who's he replying to?
He's replying to Sky Sports Premier League, and it's the headline is, "Has Loris Karius done enough to persuade Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp to keep him at Anfield next season?" And Chad Plato's just responded with just a full stop.
Right, the challenge now is, everybody listen to this, firstly, follow Chad Plato, and secondly, please, create a thread of tweets just replying with another full stop after Chad Plato's.
You know, you had a whole conversation about the best player in the world, and neither of you mentioned Chad Plato.
Who is the best player in the world?
Sam as you decided, as you worked out with actual stats, was the best player at the World Cup last year?
He was. He was. From a winger perspective, if you ignore all jobs wingers have to do apart from just getting the ball and doing something productive.
Yeah, I do. I ignore all. I did when I played. I ignore all jobs now.
Well, then, yeah, he is the best in the world. I have also responded to his full stop with a full stop.
Okay, I'll respond to yours now.
If it's patronising or not.
Can we start like a chain of full
That's what
stopping?
We're doing. That's what we're doing. Yeah. Okay. So I've just replied to yours now, Sam.
I'm seeing this in front of me. Okay. And I've also replied with a full stop from Squid Rugby account. I've replied from the Squidgy Guy.
Please, God, charge. Please don't see this as patronising. It's purely
done. There will be people that follow all three of us who are really confused right now.
This isn't going out for another week.
Hey, you know what? Right? What? Chad Plato has gained... He had 7 followers beforehand. Now he has 18.
That's pretty good.
I think this is pretty good. Checking now. No, he only had 3 followers before this. And now he's got 18.
Oh,
he's getting 15 as a result of us, right? 14 of those followers follow me. The only one that doesn't is the Windhoek Golf and Country Club, where clearly he attends because that is his hometown. So clearly it's his local golf club, right? And who seems to be someone related to him, someone else with the surname Plato, who also has never tweeted.
Chandler Plato.
Yeah.
This is a fascinating rabbit hole.
He follows Razzy Erasmus. He follows a bunch of people. Northampton Saints, London Irish. I'm genuinely quite surprised that Chad Plato hasn't signed for a professional team.
Me too. I really hope that he connects the dots and finds out that we not only respect him, but love him.
Do you know what's happened? Do you know it's just wait? Line Break Rugby have just responded with a dot as well. It's already begun. They don't even get the joke. This is why they're marvellous.
Yeah, we love them. That's phenomenal. I wonder how far this is going to go in a week before this goes up.
We've started a monster, and yeah, I'm here for it. I'm here for Chad Plato getting a professional contract in a convenient for TV watching.
I was genuinely expecting Zebra or Treviso to sign him.
Yeah.
After how well he played against Italy and their history of signing, you know, the Monte Ioannis of the world.
Yeah.
You know, he fits that mould. But yeah.
How many Twitter followers does he need? Yeah, sometimes people will say, like, will you go to my prom with me? And how many tweets do I need for that? How many tweets does Zebra need before they sign Chad Plato?
This is our new priority with this podcast. It started as a World Cup retrospective. It's now the Squid Rugby Get Chad Plato Signed for Zebra podcast.
If the chain of Chad Plato full stop tweets gets to 25, he just plays for Zebra. He has signed for Zebra, if that's the case.
I want to make the point, no one can do it more than once.
Oh,
No. That's cheating. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cheating, actually. It would be disrespectful to him because he can get there by himself.
Yeah.
But honestly, if he went to play for Zebra, no one would. He would be a good player. No one would look at him and go, well, he's out of place here. He'd be a very good player. They just need to give him the opportunity.
He's a. Like, this sounds like we're making fun of him, but he's a genuinely pretty exceptional player.
I want to make that really clear. You know, something like Langdranger, step aside. Actually, no, this makes it sound like I'm taking the piss. But ignore that.
Yeah.
Chad Plato is a really good player.
Chad Plato is the second best player to Billy Searle.
Now that sounds like you're taking the piss.
It does.
Chad Plato is a very good rugby player.
Yeah.
Yeah. Should we move on?
Yeah, let's move on.
Cool. Man of the match, Dick of the Day. Should we begin with Dick of the Day?
Sure. Should I start?
I was going to say, do you want to start?
Yeah, all right. Well, I mean, one is Tupai Ely for many reasons, mainly just dropping the ball on decent chances a few times. One is Isatola Maka for bringing off Felice at halftime when he's having a really good game.
Mm.
However, it has to go to Sean Webb for that ball going over his head and just not diving on it or anything like that. And also for stepping up to play fly half and not being able to pass. I mean, yeah. So, yeah, Sean Webb's my dick of the day.
Yeah, I feel like this is designed to have multiple answers, but it is Sean Webb, isn't it, really?
Same, yeah, Sean Webb. As you say, you've got, as well as you mentioned, Sam, the time he didn't put the ball out at half-time comes into play. You know, there's just so many contenders from that kind of 15-minute period just before half-time.
And most of them are Sean Webb.
Webb, unanimous. He is the second, I believe. Oh, no. Yeah. Third unanimous freeway dick of the day.
Wow.
After Anthony Faenga.
Of course.
And Talisa Lavea, who was properly dreadful for Samoa against Wales.
Yeah.
And man of the match?
Man of the match, I think, might also be pretty one-sided as well. Felice is one player I had written down, then came off at half-time, obviously came back on, but I don't think I can justify giving it to him. So despite being on the losing team, I just think Michael Leitch worked his socks off.
Yeah.
I think, as you say, tackling was completely, he was all over the place, and the way he carried the ball was phenomenal. He was so good. It was a shade of what he was going on to become.
Yeah, I totally agree. I will slightly throw a curveball.
Nice, good. Despite, we can't agree on everything.
despite only playing for 70 minutes, I was fully prepared coming into this game to think, ugh, you know, Arledge is, he's just a fine player, and but wait till Tamura comes along and fixes Japan. But he was really good, and he made that. He made the first two elements of that backline tick, and yeah, I think. And also, like you mentioned earlier, how much Japan miss him when he goes off that 10 minutes kind of shows his talent.
There are now two fly halves with multiple man of the match nominations over the court. I have been keeping a spreadsheet of all of this.
Yeah.
These are James Arledge and Ander Monroe. Who had that one down? We'll see if this...
Andy Monroe is.
He was the Canada fly half.
But we're not convinced he was a fly half.
He looked like a kind of N64 character who just liked to smash himself into anything he saw and also loved really aggressive drop goals. So obviously, I love him.
He's completely... He went to the University of Edinburgh. He has completely passed me by as a international level player. But, good thing.
My man of the match as well is Michael Leitch. He was the official man of the match as well, and I can't see beyond him. I thought he was... I've got a point in my notes where I wrote down, this is complete hyperbole and I don't stand by it, is Michael Leitch the best player I've ever seen?
Yeah.
He chases the man down and then wins that turnover and scores a try moments later.
It was kind of strange looking back after having watched the previous Japan games and gone, Michael Leitch was world-class the whole time.
Yeah. Like, he went from... In my head, he was like, oh, he's this, you know, really good, hard-working player they had. And he then developed. He went, oh, no, he's improved so much. He's become this world-class player.
Yeah.
Like, no, he was the whole time. He always was. Yeah. So, dick of the day. Oh, no, we've done dick of the day. We've done man of the match. We've done both of them. Dick of the day almost became me there for forgetting. So, does that bring us to the end? Have we done?
Yeah.
Have we made it?
We've all gone for losing team man of the match. No, yeah, man of the matches, which is interesting. Yeah. So,
Sam.
Go
on.
No, sorry. I was just because I like a losing man of the match. I just think give it to. I also hate when they give it to hat trick people or people who score two tries. Often when they either haven't done anything else or the tries were quite easy to get.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like that. Never mind. I was going to go down a whole rabbit hole about that, but yeah. Sam, is there anything you want to plug? Where can people find you on the internet and so on?
You can find me on Twitter at Sam L Stands Up, and nothing really to plug at the moment. It's a bit quiet with rugby. But you can actually find me in Rugby World on the 1st of September. Go and buy it rather than looking in a shop, and you know, email them and say that was a great article.
Also, email Rugby World if you buy before the 1st of September and say, I think the article by Sam Lon is going to be great. And also, the guy in 50th on your poll of the most influential people in rugby is really underrated. Razzy Rasmus thinks he understands the game.
I'm not sure about that. Yeah, thanks again for coming on, Sam. Really enjoyed that. And also, I guess, as well, ever since you first came on, you've really helped us with sort of supporting the podcast and everything, and that's great. So Thanks again for coming on.
Well, that's my pleasure. I really enjoy what you both do. So thanks a lot for having me.
Cheers. No, it's great to have you back. It's good insight and good humour as always. So cheers. Thanks.
Well, thank you both for joining in. Thank you to everyone for listening. And what can I say except you're welcome.
Bye.
God.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.